to say thank you to Mr. Ferguson for the filing of the River EU's house, but Portland's even just like to reserve its position in case it does need to respond in closing to any matters that are raised in there.
Well, certainly everyone will have the opportunity to provide a closing. If anyone feels taken by surprise or otherwise feels the need to do more than respond by submissions, let us know and we'll assess that in all circumstances. If you are thinking of doing that, please confer with your friends before you if there's no objection and the likelihood would be we would grant leave that
resource. Thank you, sir.
As indicated yesterday, I intend to start with the legal submission for CMA Land Management Limited. By way of a preliminary comment, we've had another discussion, albeit remotely, with Ms. Robson. She's considering her position. I will endeavour to confirm the position later today, since she was apprehensive about her evidence being rendered submission only, which I thought was potentially what Your Honour was suggesting as one option.
Oh, it would be one option, depending on the depending on the position of other parties.
Yes. Alternatively, she wondered whether she could swear it as an affidavit, and if there were, wasn't it her original evidence that there was very limited reply to, apart from, I think, Mr. Woodford, but if there were no questions, they could equally be done in writing in an expeditious time, conscious of that court may have questions as well in that regard.
I mean, we have, as I've noted on several occasions, particularly recently, an extraordinarily broad power to receive just about anything. The issue obviously comes down to fairness overall. If any party felt there were an issue on fairness, we could look at a more formal process. But as with the point Ms. Ford raised in relation to other material we're presenting, if there's no objection or other particular issue, then we'd rather take it all in and have it available for consideration. And if it is a statement by a suitably qualified expert witness, we would treat it as evidence. Weight, obviously, might be an issue, but again, for planning witnesses, probably there's not a great deal of difference to be made in relation to weight, as long as you're considering their opinion about the efficacy of the plan provision. And take that into account with everyone else's opinion about that plan.
Thank you, sir. As I indicated yesterday also, there were, I thought there were two, but there were three documents that Ms. Robson had hoped to produce. And just recapping what they are, one was a map showing the age classes of the CFL forests that are within the catchment, which is a very checkered map with different age classes and small blocks all over that run through until, and as I've indicated in the submission, run through to 2024. Some of those forests have been planted as recently as 2019. Others as old as 2003, I think. So that's still got a little bit of life, and even the early ones are going to be harvested.
that your appendix two to your submission?
No, that's simply a location map for orientation. As there was really a good one when I went through everything, and I'll turn to that.
Sorry, Mr. Johnson, is Ms. Robson proposing to file these additional documents?
She was going to bring them with her. wherever she is at the moment, which is.
Can she send them?
I'm going to try and get electronic copies. There is one which I think she has been sent through already, which I will send to the registrar, which is the CNI lands with their land use capability rankings on them. And the third document was just for completeness. CNI collective does actually have an environment plan, which is lodged with the regional council, and I think that's a document that can come in.
Well, those all sound like primary fact type documents, unless somebody has some issue about their problems, then we receive those through you quite happily.
Thank you, sir. Perhaps before giving you referred to the map and before kind of starting the submission, if I can just do some orientation in relation to that map, because this is a map of all of the CNI forest lands, so the full 170,000 hectares, but in the boundary line that runs down the middle of the, I think it's Salmon Hugh, is the regional council boundary. Now, everything to the left of that is within the Waikato catchment in its hydrological sense, but that bottom foot, a bit like the one off the foot of Italy, which has a number 5 written on it. That is the Waimihia forest, which is actually in the Lake Taupō catchment. And so, for the purposes of the Waimana, that line excludes the catchment of Lake Taupō. So, if you see the state highway that goes. Then, if you took the state highway line straight down to an intersection of that vertically, there's a thin sliver of land that runs down that line that's within the river catchment, and everything else to the left of it is outside. But the other map that will be produced will make it clear. Now, in terms of CNI, and I don't propose to read these, I just want to highlight some points in relation to it. There are obviously 8 iwi involved in the CNI effective in the CNI arrangements, and in relation to Te Arawa, that have a number of component parts, as footnote 3 indicates.
And I think everyone is presumably aware of Jeff Williams' affiliations, but there's no issue that I can see in relation to the conflict.
No, none whatsoever, and for two primary reasons, at the very least, one of which is that I suspect that those interests, or those affiliated interests, through Papa Papa, largely sit to the east of that line. And secondly, I note this in the submission, the CNI iwi collective environment plan, which I describe as a pan-tribal planning document for the purpose of the CNI lands, 7 of the 8 iwi are a party to that, and the iwi that is not is my tūhoe, and as the Zonov will be well aware, that reflects their political view about Māori Matauke and speaking for their own resources. but they are otherwise fully within the peak. But I agree, there is no issue there. So the point I was going to make, which kind of flows slightly from that, is that while the CNI lands are currently held in the collective, the intention is that they will at some point in the 2040s be allocated according to a Manapinoa process among the Aotearoa according to those Manapinoa interests. In the period between now and then, they will have a commercial interest in the proceeds of the rentals, but from that point on, there may be a different division. It's fair to say that that process is a work in progress and is already a subject of some court time. What I would say is that the area we are predominantly looking at within the catchment and without prejudice to determinations ultimately in a Manapinoa sense in terms of allocation of the CNI CFL land is broadly accepted to be predominantly within the areas of interest of Tukarepua. Certainly every hapu within Te Arawa and Raukawa, albeit that they aren't seeking a share in the Manapinoa in relation to those areas, but they do have a rather large area of interest, so I don't want to preclude them from that acknowledgement. And there is obviously, therefore, in terms of Tūwharetoa, certain hapu of Te Arawa and Raukawa, commonality of interest, albeit not quite identity in terms of representative bodies, as there are different representative bodies for the CNI settlement for at least Tūwharetoa and Te Arawa, but for the Raukawa it's a common post-settlement governance entity for both countries, but they are involved in part to and privy to the Riverewe involvement in PC1 as well. The appellant in the body I represent is the MIUE Land Management Limited and has indicated they are essentially the land managers on behalf of the holding trust that currently holds the land, which is all subject to ongoing Crown Forest licences that are now being operated by Pangaroa Timberlands. And so, very small areas have been returned to date in that, and it is an ongoing process. But the historical context of that, as I indicated in the written submission, can be found within the Waitangi Tribunal's here among a formal report on the Central North Island claims, and I've set out some relevant passages from that that provide some context to the historical actions and the reality of the impediments that now encumber those lands, despite their return. And despite their innate value, which is far beyond its current use of forestry purposes.
So in terms of the forestry lands, is it proposed that Ms. Robson is going to identify these additional documents when the particular CFLs expire and so on?
Yes, the map that shows the half states, which I think one can do some extrapolation from, two comments in relation to that. One, the harvest blocks are much smaller than a CFL scale, so and I'll clarify if there is not a scale on the map how big those are. Secondly, Kangaroa Timberlands were happy to disclose all of the planting dates. At the moment, my understanding is that they're looking for the harvesting at about a 28-year age, but that has quite a bit of scope for movement according to demand, price and other factors, so they weren't prepared to share their projected harvest dates because that's commercially sensitive for them, so that's not the MIU, it's two answers information it is. We've got it.
For our purposes, we don't need that level of precision.
No, it's plus 25 to 30 years from the dates that are indicated as to planting.
Yeah.
will be have estates.
And in a number of circumstances, not all, but a number of circumstances, there would also be an issue of replanting.
There are, yes, a significant issue in terms of ETS liability, at the very least, not to replant. It's an unusual situation in that legally Timberland's on ending the HCFL at the end of their term of the licence, are required to have land in a position where it is fit for replanting, but they're not required to replant.
Right.
Which is quite an irony when you were talking about future land use change, and essentially the land use change has been affected, and CNI will inherit the obligation to replant, or they in default of a change of land use that they haven't had any control over whatsoever, which is an interesting scenario, not one I think Resource Management Act or general principles can see have already contemplated.
Well, no, whether or not that's a matter to be taken up again with the Crown.
Oh, certainly, sir. And
we'll just steer clear of that.
And not to replant under the current ETS regime has a huge financial implications, which is another one of the factors that are, which go towards that this is not a prospect that suddenly, if we were to shift from non-complying to discretionary, or even as my friend promotes restricted discretionary, there's any prospect of suddenly 34,000 hectares of trees being harvested any time soon, forever.
Well, and I think that the court has some concerns about the use of an activity classification or activity status to try and drive that sort of outcome, as opposed to the use of that status for the purposes of managing fields.
Yes, yeah. And probably jumping somewhat ahead, but usefully that was the essential buy-in from Tangata Whenua, and I say that in a broader sense of certainly the River Iwi, CNI being supportive or not opposed in principle to that, was that was very much a hold the line, we're all going to suck it up, this is our contribution, we're going to put this off to that short expiry date in the hope that we'll make some traction, we'll then have some focus rules being made. And of course, things have slipped the other way, and so that's been revisited. And I think fairly so. And I've outlined, as I say, in paragraph 15 and 16, that concern, which is the way that the various mechanisms that kind of point on their face towards a pathway to defending ancestral land, in the way that ultimately ended up through the hearing panel's decision, have had additional obstacles either expressly applied to them, or they have slipped further back in the prioritisation due to the affirmative steps taken to recognise things such as the CVP expansion, intensification of certain other farmlands, and prospect of further creep within that, and then also the doubling down of the removal of the end date from that non-complying land use change rule, if that was to remain the sole avenue, meaning that as long as that remains in place, that rule, and there is no alternative, then that's the only gateway.
I mean, these are a range of factors, and some of them I think present greater complexity than others. I think that the reference, the express reference to Te Ture Paimana in one place and not in others, I'm not sure how far one needs to go in attempting to analyse that.
No, but I think it's unfortunate. I think it was intended. I think there are references to Te Ture Whaumana that were included in places that were intended to be positive and supportive, rather than constraining, because they were looking to particular objectives of Te Ture Whaumana that rightly do provide foundation for that development, But Te Tiri Whai Mana in itself, and certainly giving effect to it, or necessary to give effect to it, is Te Tiri Whai Mana as a whole, which is necessarily a direction and a step.
Well, an impediment to the implementation of the Resource Management Act has been a tendency to have objectives and policies that simply restate Section 5 of the Act without doing what the Act actually intends, which is to develop the principle or the purpose of sustainable management to more particular circumstances. And I think that also applies to just general application of the Te Tiri Whai Mana without necessarily thinking, well, what will this mean in the particular circumstances that the plan or the part of the plan is seeking to address? Yeah.
And look, and certainly at a high level, I think Plan Change 1 appropriately has grappled with Te Tiri Whai Mana and tried to give expression to it, but then having these residual references, they're not going to be populated throughout or unhelpful. I mean, I think the situation that Your Honour is alluding to, without directly so, is perhaps what we were all grappling with in the Consequences of Variation 6, where Te Tiri Whai Mana had simply been dropped in as an objective of to give effect to Te Tiri Whai Mana. Oh, now it's in the regional plan.
Well, so we've done it.
Which helps no one. I mean, CNI, their position is narrower and more focused than the River Iwi, and that's why it's appropriate to make it separate, because they don't wish to speak for that broader whole of catchment. They are obviously very much in the upper catchment, neighbouring on Wailaka Pastoral for the large part, they do want to kind of stick within that realm. They are fully supportive of the River Iwi necessarily, so they obviously wish to utilise their lands that they have participated in other plan changes elsewhere to that end, which have involved allocation methodologies. They fully appreciate, as Ms. Wilson said, the evidence that allocation needs to occur. She would and favoured the original Note of the Road version that gave some greater expression to that step, that allocation would have to come, and which also identified some of the principles that may be relevant to that, which were removed on the basis that it was felt that was kind of predetermining and preordaining things beyond the life of the plan, which were matters that were appropriate to another conceded authority at a future date. And I can understand the principle of that, but we are talking here about a document that clearly has a intergenerational and definitely inter-plan life, and I think appropriately connectivity and future direction that speaks to future plan changes is not inappropriate, and I don't think out of scope in terms of what can really be done. I think we've got quite a unique driver here that legally, legislatively.
Discussing it now is not out of scope, but I think that the logic of trying to ensure that there is a policy and rule framework that can be settled for the way in which existing land uses are operating is a sensible thing to do prior to moving into the question of how future allocation, there having been no allocation of processing status. We need to settle where we stand now before we move into a future allocation process. So, I mean, that's, I think, how the court sees the logic of this. But no, we're not putting blinkers on in relation to the reality of what even the next plan change may need to include in order to maintain progress towards the objectives of the Te Tiri Whai Mana.
Thank you, sir. And I do address that in a little bit more detail for the River Iwi, necessarily so, because matters of allocation and associated rights and interests in freshwater sit more comfortably within the Iwi camp than within perhaps the more corporatised structure of CNI as it currently exists. So, but I might return to that at that point. But certainly, I can say that CNI have been greatly assured by the at least comments and indications in the course of the hearing as they have observed them, or read them, I should say, that we are firmly not talking about grandparenting, and we're not talking about allocation in PC1. I am not doing it and preordaining the framing of that, but we aren't pretending it doesn't need to happen at some future point. But we obviously need a tool and a methodology to properly do that, which is a challenge we do have with a PC1. So I think what I've introduced in terms of legal principles is perhaps moving from Te Tiriti Whaimana and then into the historical context of those impediments do resonate through the more orthodox provisions of Part 2 of the RMA in terms of 16, 7 and 18 and the relevant principles of the treaty, particularly the principles in relation to the right to development and equity and how that resonates. Now I think those things are appropriately given avenues of expression through Te Tiriti Whaimana, through certain of those objectives, and the fact that Te Tiriti Whaimana emanates from a treaty settlement context and purposively and as a matter of interpretation and reference back to that means that those touchstones are appropriate for CNI to make and are relevant factors when one is considering the appropriateness of amending the rule framework or policies to give greater expression and connectivity to removing or reducing, I would say, one of the impediments being to land use change.
Certainly, I the awareness of this, and that I appreciate the aspiration or the objective of Māori being able to utilise in a commercial sense or economic sense lands which they receive by way of treaty settlement, or lands which they actually pour in halt in whatever form that may be. But I do confess I'm struggling a little bit with the utilisation of that land where it may contravene to define money in terms of the ability to restore the whole. So I am struggling a little bit with that component of things.
Yes.
Can you help me with that?
Look, and I think from a general perspective, that was at the heart of the original proposition that, and as to Te Tiriti Whaimana demands, we're all to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to take up the words that the Commissioner, or the principle that Commissioner Hodges has reminded, everyone has to do their share. So from a CNI and certainly from a River Iwi, and I'm sure the Iwi of Hobaki perspective, but my friend's perspective there, there's been a substantial share and weight and burden and deprivation that the Iwi Tangata Whenua have borne going right back to 1860 in large parts of this catchment. And to suggest that I suppose we're all having to give up things now, and I suggest that everyone's on an equal playing field already, and I think there's an element to that. That said, the River Iwi at least were firm that they were happy to endure for a limited period a non-complying land use activity status, land change activity status, on the premise that there was going to be no further degradation, i.e. no further intensification, no further extension within the same life of that, i.e. the life of PC1. And therefore that was their contribution. In the absence, and the River Iwi aren't, and CNI isn't here saying that all of those things have to be reset or removed, that take quite a bit of unwinding. I think there are some issues in relation to the CVP expansion, which I think have been traversed, and certainly my friends to the right have been hot on that. And Steve and I have really both acknowledged that. They also acknowledge the importance of CVP as a national issue, but as soon as you make those shifts, with anyone in mind, as a matter of fairness and equity and good conscience, the commitment that River Iwi, CNI and others made by not seeking to have a different status in the development of PC1. And therefore, if there is to be that scope, then River Iwi certainly and CNI accept that there will still need to be some way, there will still need to be some degree of satisfaction met that there is the capacity without material diminution and kind of quality and water quality and those things to have land use change and to engage in those activities. They accept, given the complete absence, with respect of any progress since 2016 on a freshwater accounting framework, that it's going to be very difficult to empirically prove that on a case-by-case basis, but that the predictions are that if all of these other methodologies are in place, we will be tracking down, and there should be an opportunity at least to take advantage of that headroom within the short term. Again, the scale and relativity of even a discretionary activity application, those matters were thought to be considered. And I think it's about providing a clearer vehicle for that and probably jumping ahead, but one of the changes that Mr. Brough has proposed in terms of Policy 18 is to add reference to that as a factor to be recognised, which is the extent to which there have been cumulative reductions at the appropriate catchment and sub-catchment level. So that would be one of the factors within the policy.
Creating that headspace.
Yeah, there's one of the factors that reasonably sits within that policy. So as you're tracking through, River Iwi and I are acknowledging that it's something they're going to have to deal with. But equally, if we're talking about, you know, I think people often look at things from the extremes that, you know, we're going to cut down trees and create dairy farms. That's been done extensively and recently within this catchment. But there are other much more subtle changes from forestry, which is low intensity in any event, to, for example, CVP, two other types of land use that have a much smaller and probably in the same margins as some of the things that are allowed under PC1 as it's currently drafted. A way of trying to allow those things to be advanced and explored without just having the barrier of non-compliant activity status is the desire that's placed before the court. The other thing that Ms. Robson, if she was here, would probably say if anybody was going to ask her a question about the topic, and as said members of the bench will be aware, she is greatly interested from a planning perspective in the broader issue of modelling and alternatives to oversee, and has been for some time. She's not an expert in that, but she did inform me that she's been actively involved in a group of expert modellers in recent months and was going to share that. I merely say that I deserve that there are obviously initiatives and steps being taken. I am sad and personally and as well as quite a blunt that these things have not been actively championed and pushed and funded from the day the PC1 was initiated. But I think that it's critical that those types of processes are able to be given through life and are supported by agencies, by councils, by the local authorities, the extent of camera permits, to ensure that we do collectively and collaboratively as a catchment community work together towards identifying and developing a methodology and a framework that will be fit for purpose for what we need to deliver on to Te Tiriti Whamana over the next 80 years, but certainly we need something up and running within the next 5 to 10 years in my submission.
Well, I think as the court understands that there's a great deal of work being done at the scientific level in trying to understand what is going on in the mechanisms, as it were. Ordinarily, that work should precede the modelling work or the building of models. So it may be that, you know, yes, the work is being done, but it's being done at the earlier stage, and the modellers should be anxious to see what's emerging from the on-the-ground investigations of how nitrogen behaves in the environment.
And I don't disagree, Your Honour, and I think it is it's probably a submission I was going to make, and that's why these submissions have actually kind of weaved together to some extent, is that my observation would be that I think it's imperative that these disparate initiatives that are occurring become connected, like the waters themselves, like White Hustle and White Hustle. And, you know, there's a whakatauke that's used in Whanganui about, you know, the small streams,
yeah.
Large streams come together and form one mighty river. And
right.
That has to happen with the people and the participants as well.
Yeah.
And I think the Riverie would say, and C and I would agree, that the collaborative stakeholder group process was a good one. Despite the fact that not everyone agreed with everything, but that sometimes it could find a good process. But unfortunately, and this is, you know, criticism, although people can make many criticisms about the resource management frameworks, once things moved into a hearing committee stage, the natural tendency of people to retreat to their corners, those conversations stopped to a large extent, and here we are 7 years later already from that period. If that collaborative type process had continued, championed by the council, with some funding from the council, central government, involving the river area, involving the councils, involving the river authority, involving the farming sector groups, crown agencies, fish and game, if one can only imagine where we might have got to if they had been championing a freshwater accounting system and related matters over that last 7 year period. And I think the one thing that perhaps has been revealed through this court's process, which is I think we've had a much greater coming together than perhaps we have had over much of the last 7 years, and that's not a criticism of any one party at all. And I think that going forward, whatever the shape of this is, I think that's imperative to success and implementation long term. And certainly the Riverie, we see and I support that. I haven't spoken to my friend, but he's really a Riverie. For the iwi of Hauraki, once their settlement arrangements and those two catchments come online, once the legislation is passed, working with the council, with the river authority, I think, and others, there's a real opportunity there. So
we had evidence of other processes. Yesterday we had evidence that the Pukekohe growers are working collaboratively with the local people there. We had the evidence of the Cambridge wastewater plant, which is, I think from the experience of the court in relation to consenting for wastewater treatment plants, a remarkable process, and one that I think might be used as a very good example of how co-governance can actually achieve really good things for the whole of the community.
Despite the branding, yes.
But that comes back to, I think, your point, which is that sometimes when things move into a representative realm of some kind, and as you say, people retreat to their corners and slogans are adopted, and critical thinking is in second place to whether or not you're doing what you said on stump you would do.
Yes, that's a fair observation. I'm not sure whether, in view of that conversation that we've had, that I need to emphasise other matters.
I think that it's important, obviously, that the position of CNI be placed very clearly in front of us. You have helpfully identified the particular matters that are of concern. I think that there are linkages, aren't there, to the concerns that the iwi have.
Certainly in relation to the tangata interest around the aspect, the freshwater accounting aspect, the agency aspect, yes.
And we're in no doubt that there is a need to identify pathways there has to be an advance in terms of reduction in discharge of contaminants. Within that, it seems that you have a focus on using some of that improvement for headroom. And I don't think there's any doubt about the basis on which that's been put in front of us. The question is, how can that be done in the context of these particular provisions? And if given that we aren't addressing allocation, it may be that we can only point towards ways, and we'll need to leave the actual process for identifying any headroom and allocation.
That's right, yes.
To a later process.
We're probably not producing this to be a committed activity rule with prescribing limits by quantity, area, land type, or otherwise, as we've grappled with in other spaces. We simply, the data set doesn't exist for anybody in that respect. That's understood clearly. But we are seeking an appropriate mechanism, acknowledging, certainly from a CNI perspective, that question of headroom or relative reduction, or if there's a slight increase, and we've heard people talking about, oh, it's 0.9, it's just 0.9, every grain of sand adds to the quantity of the beach, but that said, it's not, no one is suggesting, that headroom should be created to be then fully occupied by the development of Tangatea ancestral land. That has never been the goal or aspiration. The reduction is paramount for them too. There's a lack of that layer of that headroom, a thin veneer perhaps that can reasonably be accessed without doing disservice to the trajectory. And obviously the extent to which that might become a bigger space relative to progress will be necessarily dependent on us being able collectively, and I think that applies to anybody wanting to do anything, the prospect of further restrictions on activities that are currently, even under PC1, going to be allowed is a, has to be a real prospect for everybody if we don't.
Well, this comes back to the issue, and Mr. Crockett's on the disposal of Fisher James, is whether any kind of adaptive management must nonetheless remain, whatever the permitted standards may be.
Yes.
The use of practicability or best practicable options is premised on the idea that if improvements can be made, they will be made.
Mm.
And so stasis is not something that we're looking to achieve, to be by mana. And the only other thing I suppose about that is in the complexity of all of this, the recognition that it's going to take a long time, but nonetheless the huge importance to make significant gains early, otherwise we won't make the gains that we're hoping to make in the long term. Unless Ted Maxwell comes in today. So, anything more then in relation
to... Nothing more in relation to CMIC.
Well then I think the important thing is for the court to clarify the position in relation to Ms. Robson's statement. For you to indicate how soon you may be able to get us these other things that have to go with it. And you might just want to remain there. We'll see if anybody does want to come forward on this. Does anyone want to address us about what I think I've generally indicated is the approach we'll take to Ms. Robson's statement? In particular, is there anyone who feels prejudiced if they are unable to ask questions of Ms. Robson? No. Is there anyone who considers that we would be going a step too far if we were to receive her statement as an evidential statement, acknowledging that we will consider the weight that we give to it in the way we would even if she were here in person, and we will obviously receive and consider any submissions about the weight we ought to give to it from any party? Would you mind?
So I guess in the, just in the matter of consistency, I did raise concerns with Rock Hill Farm in relation to the further evidence filed there.
Yes.
I do raise the same issue here.
Yes.
But I, as a matter of fairness, and I don't intend to take any further than that, but just for the record, just for consistency, it's just a matter of fairness of the new evidence.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I fully accept that a key element of justice is consistency.
Yes.
And as I say, you are welcome to make any appropriate submissions in relation to how we treat Ms. Robson's evidence, as you can for any of the witnesses who we have here. But thank you.
Thank you.
Acknowledge your point.
Thank you.
Anyone else? No. Well, then I think we will receive Ms. Robson's statement as evidence. We would ask you to try and make sure that the secure documents are circulated as soon as possible. If there are further issues that arise in relation to those matters, we may have to call on you again. Otherwise, it may well be something that can be dealt with on the 5th of December.
Yes, I just wonder whether the maps, having not seen anything but a glimpse of them, might give rise to some supplementary information requests or clarification, but that's something the court has done with other groups of the subject matter in the course of this hearing. So again, people have been able to comment on that.
All right, so that's the case for CNR. Thank you. We might just take 10 minutes now. You're going to move straight on with the referee and with the witnesses there.
Yes.
And we've received this morning, I think, your submissions. Yes. All right. So we might just have a quick squiz at those and then come back in about 10 minutes. Thank you. Thank you.
understanding the maps that the council usefully provided at the outset that were, I think, taken off the Kahui Maunga website, maintained by the Queen Kukuri, of the kind of areas of interest as recorded in the general sense, often taken from pre-settlements and other information. I thought it was useful. Helpful to just indicate within the catchment and with reference to the catchment of the Waikato River and parts of it, the areas in which each of the five river iwi have and engage through the joint management agreements that they have with the council. Apologies, they're not all of the same quality, but the first one is for the Te Awa River iwi, and in that regard, as the submissions note, there are three iwi within that class, which are three groups of a much wider number of Te Awa River iwi that have interest in the Waikato River co-management, governance arrangements, and in terms of the area of interest in the joint management area, it is located in that upper Waikato catchment, marked on that map, which, as you see, covers almost precisely all of the CMI lands, but that is part of the course in terms of the overlaps that we now exist between the groupings across the Mutu. And so that provides not only an indication of the collective of those three iwi groupings that operate through the Te Awa River iwi and the Te Awa River iwi Trust in terms of a representative organisation, but it shows a delineation between the subgroups and the Te Awa Whaiwa and the Tūrarangi Ngāti Waiheo immediately north of that, and then over to the west, Ngāti Kihiroa, Ngāti Tuara. The second page then is Raukawa, a little bit more expensive and coming right across over the same area as Te Awa River iwi, and obviously expanding far left, effectively, for the purpose of their joint management agreement. And again, these things, like all maps, models, data, they're all wrong to some extent, and from someone's perspective. But their area requires all of what is known as Area B, which I return to as the highlight on there, which they exercise interest through the co-management arrangements at the very least. To the north of Lake Tokyo, so this is just from the other side of the edge of the Lake Tokyo catchment, but also in that upper catchment for the Waikato area. So they go from that cut-off line, which everyone refers to as falls, and I think it's even referred to as Hooker Falls in the legislation. In fact, is Te Tokoro Tia, it's a rock that's about 50 metres away from the falls. It's actually the line, but Te Awa Whiti like to have things specifically described sometimes. That's where that line is, and then it obviously goes down a significant extent, but not encompassing all of the area. The boundary there is another map, not for the purpose, that shows the northern edge of what was the original 1886 Tokyo New Tier block, which is often a touchstone for Tikwari Tor in relation to their Lake Tokyo connective interest in that. Probably just travels just along the southern side of the Waikato River that flows their area of interest extends to much further north and then overlaps with Te Aroha and Raukawa again. In relation to Maniapoto, their area is predominantly what's known as Area C, which is the white bar catchment, predominantly what coming down into certain areas within Area A, and then crossing over into the proper catchment in that regard. So that's their area of interest for this purpose and the area of their claim management agreement. And then finally, from that for Waikato Tainui, and it is a little bit difficult to see, there are a number of things being shown on this map, but it is the orange area, which has a very difficult sequence of pink line around it, that is the co-management, or JMA area, for Waikato Tainui. The red line that is slightly bigger to the north and going out to the coast on the west is the Rokatu confiscation boundary from 1963, and as you will see, that confiscation not only took the land, but it took the predominant length of the river. And the numbers are there, affiliated marae, which obviously extend beyond and broader than that zone as well. Store, British Water Council, my friend Sanjuri Kaliwi of Hauraki, show those Hauraki interests come down from the Hauraki Plains in towards, into the Manatangi and right to, up to the Whangamarino catchment. And there is a forest immediately adjacent to that, to the swamp, to the north. East, which is Crown Forest land, which is the Mamarua Forest, which is kept us still on the Hauraki redress list. but those, the existence of those interests, we're not here to argue boundaries between any of the river we. Between the River Iwi and Hauraki, or otherwise.
Understanding the presence of His Honour from the Māori Land Court, do you keep that issue outside this jurisdiction?
Yes, we've done our best. We've only mentioned once to the Māori Land Court, so far. We'll work out those those arrangements, as I indicated in the evidence that every code of do see participation and co-management arrangements coming down into those two catchments which are within Area A. Extends a bit beyond outside Area A as well, but not being to talk to that. There's no dispute about that for present purposes. I do want to pause at a few places of these submissions. Do appreciate you have received them very late in the piece, and they are somewhat longer than my partner's submissions that arrived at a similar time, which you probably have read. But there are some aspects of this. I don't want to read through these by any stretch, but I just want to highlight some matters that I think are pertinent and some follow on from this morning. I did want to acknowledge from the start start with the words of Tafioa from 1863, Tokioa, Koyora, Miuna, Pikonga. The river of life, each curve more beautiful than the last. Words taken from a Mamai Aroha lament of his recording his love and reverence for the Waikato River and the significance of the tikuna awa as a tāna for all generations. And importantly, it's those words that are the opening words of the Tiri Whamana, or they are often skipped over for the clause 2, which has what's commonly referred to as the vision. But as such, they not only frame the expectation for the actions that are necessary to respond to the vision and aspirations of the kupuna of the Waikato and Waipai rivers, and each of the rangatira of the River Iwi who negotiated the Waikato River Settlement and the related Waikato and Waipai River deeds, but they are a fundamental part of the statutory touchstone against which the technical and policy proposals within PC1 must be assessed. I don't propose to dwell on anything else in terms of the introduction other than to note, which I think I did right on day one of the hearing, and that is that there is a change in party name on the part of Ngāti Maniapoto, who in the court proceedings and in the appeal documents and the related matters have been in the name of the Maniapoto Māori Trust Board, but with the conclusion and enactment of the Maniapoto Claims Settlement Act 2022, the Maniapoto Māori Trust Board has now been dissolved and it's been succeeded to, for all intents and purposes, including expressive litigation, with a clause that I've referenced in the footnote to section 218 of that Act, which essentially replaces the Trust Board with Te Nihi Nihi Nui in any extent proceedings. So Te Nihi Nihi Nui is the post-settlement government's entity for the area of Maniapoto, and they have now taken on responsibilities in terms of the earlier co-management and other arrangements in relation to the Waikato and Waipa rivers that were previously exercised by the Trust Board under their 2007 deed and the upper the Waipa River legislation. Preliminary comments are probably worth reading just to clarify the context. First, the River Iwi, like the Waikato and Waipai rivers themselves, collectively are central to the identity, health and well-being. Their identity, their health and well-being is Iwi, and they are foundational to the Plan Change 1 process in many respects, including not the development and legal recognition of the Te Rere Whaimana in the context of the Waikato River Settlement and its legislation, which obviously expressly includes Te Rere Whaimana and recognises that Te Rere Whaimana is intended by Parliament to be the primary direction-setting document for the Waikato River and activities within its catchment affecting the river, and deems Te Rere Whaimana to be part of the regional policy statement. And that overarching purpose of the Waikato River Settlement, consistent with the vision of Te Rere Whaimana, is to restore and protect the health and well-being of the Waikato River for future generations. And those arrangements which were first negotiated by Waikato Tainui were then reinforced and supplemented by the deeds that were subsequently entered into by the Crown of Adventure of the Act for River Iwi that I represent, and that consequently reflected in two additional pieces of legislation, the Ngāti Tuwharetoa Raukawa and Te Arawa River Iwi Waikato River Act 2010, quite a mouthful, the Waikato River Act, and that Act covers Area B, so just by way of articulation in case members aren't aware. The Waikato River arrangement in Te Tiri Whaimana applies over the entire catchment in terms of areas A and B, which included the Waikato River and its catchment from the mouth, the Port Waikato, all the way to Hooker Falls, and up the Waipa River, which is a tributary of the Waikato, as far as its confluence with the Pūmi River. So the lower Waipa is all within the original scope of Te Tiri Whaimana. Within that, though, Waikato recently acknowledged that its area of interest stopped at Karakura, and therefore, sitting below the overarching claim of Te Tiri Whaimana, there are specific co-governance arrangements that are attached to the iwi themselves, and Waikato's co-management arrangements therefore relate to that area A from Karakura to Port Waikato. And then the second piece of legislation, the Upper River Act, relates to Area B, which goes from Karapiro through to Hooker Falls, and that therefore has the three areas of interest in that area as parties to that legislation, albeit that they have their own individual arrangements within that joint legislation. And then thirdly, and this was an extension not only of the iwi involved and an additional claim management arrangements for Maniapoto with government councils, but an expansion of the area geographically that the City of Whanganui then embraced to encompass the whole of the Waipa and its catchment, and that was effected through the Ngāwai or Maniapoto Waipa River Act 2012. And so those three acts have a significant degree of commonality, and they hunt together, as it were, over the entire catchment. But there are some nuanced peculiarities that are reflected in negotiation and legislative history, which meant that despite the fact that all of the whole of river framework, including Te Tiri Whaimana, the establishment of the Waikato River Authority, etc., were completely enacted through the Waikato legislation, the Upper River legislation repeats all of those same provisions as a matter of fairness and equity. And unfortunately, it would have been a perfect world if the sections had followed the same numbering, but there's an extra acknowledgement somewhere, and they're all out by one or two section numbers throughout. Now, Maniapoto...
Just to keep you on your toes.
Just to make sure that we don't take anything for granted. There are a couple of other subtle differences too, just to add to the quirks. Maniapoto, being much more pragmatic, obviously, were quite happy simply to have the Waipa River legislation cross-reference the relevant provisions of the Waikato River legislation and say, all those now apply here too, which is a lot simpler. But that is what it is. Now, the other interesting change, when we look at the overarching purposes of the Act, the overarching purpose of the Waikato River Settlement and its Act was to restore, as I said, restore and protect the health and well-being of the Waikato River for future generations. For the Upper River iwi, thinking for the now as well as the future, is to restore and protect the health and well-being of the Waikato River for present and future generations. And then Maniapoto go a step further and change the wording a little bit more and talk about restoring and maintaining the quality and integrity of the waters that flow into and form part of the Waipa River for present and future generations, and the care and protection of the mana tuku iho or waia. And the footnote explains what that is a reference to in terms of ancestral authority and prestige handed down from generation to generation from waia, which is they refer to as the kind of personification of the waters and well-being of the Waipa River. So, different language all to a relatively common effect, but great that people try and see their way through and interpret and apply when one's dealing with the whole of catchments, our set of arrangements. Importantly, albeit that each of the river iwi have their own joint management agreements with the regional council, which say that individually the council and each iwi will come together and discuss how to progress relevant plan changes, etc. The iwi decided to come together and essentially join those five JMA processes into one for the purpose of PC1. So there was a joint working party to work with Hopu, comprising executive officers of the five river iwi and officers from the council, which provided management oversight of the project. And then sitting above that was the Healthy Rivers Waiora Committee, comprising five elected councillors and one trustee of each of the five rivers who had government's oversight of the project and who were responsible for that ultimate final joint recommendation to the council as a whole on the content of PC1.
But as I understand some of the questioning that you're putting, I think it was to Ms. Ma the other day about the engagement between Waikato River and WRC. It's very much perhaps at previous stages that he spoke of that role?
That's in relation to the next plan change, which is, my friends and their clients are working on some acceleration, so it's helpful, but that's in relation to the plan change that was required to give effect to the extent necessary NPS Freshwater Management 2020, where we heard evidence that a lot of work had been done, but it hadn't quite been done yet through the co-management processes that are required. So there will need to be some refocus in a very short time on that to make sure we can have the same kind of process in place to the extent possible.
And in terms of the engagements that have been had in the co-management arrangement, how have they been going?
What I would observe is that, and he won't thank me for this, is that Mr. Bruff has been involved throughout and closely with BWE, both collectively in this process, but also individually in a range of capacities, going right back to quite an early stage. And he can probably provide a fairer and more appropriate observation about that to the extent he feels comfortable doing so. I don't propose to go through the next, the rest of that in great detail. Otherwise, other than to simply say and reinforce, which was probably clear when I was presenting for CNI, that in paragraph 9, given the history and that sits behind these arrangements and the establishment of the Tiwhānau and reflected in the relationship of the River Iwi with the mana whenua, individually and collectively, with the rivers and the lands within their catchments, which is enshrined through their legislation, they are therefore understandably and unapologetically committed to the realisation of the Tiwhānau. But in doing that, they equally acknowledge first that the achievement of the vision within Te Tiwhānau, the future where a healthy Waikato river sustains abundant life and prosperous communities, who in turn are all responsible for restoring and protecting the health and well-being of the Waikato River and all it embraces for generations to come, is a long-term and staged process which has realistically been timed to occur over an 80-year period. And PC1 forms the initial, albeit very important, stage of that journey. The River Iwi are also well aware that the understandings, principles and actions established through PC1 now, while they will inevitably develop and evolve over the journey towards the realisation of Te Tiwhānau, and likely be further refined in certain aspects at least in the context of the pending NPS FM 2020 plan review process over the next 18 months, are fundamental to the ongoing progress and ultimate success of that journey. And to that end, the River Iwi first welcome the assistance of the Environment Court, and in particular, whether intended or not, the inquisitorial approach that it has adopted, and at least has been commented on by the River Iwi, that the inquisitorial approach is much appreciated in terms of testing propositions and understanding what is required to improve, review and improve the elements, objectives, policies and roles of PC1 to better enable and progress to the final through the life of PC1 and, so far as possible, within limits, to use the term, beyond. And secondly, notwithstanding its own appeal and the inherent nature of these appeal proceedings, the River Iwi have sought and continue to participate in the proceedings, as they did in the process that led to the development of PC1 in a non-adversarial and collaborative fashion to the best that they possibly can in circumstances. Now, the overview of the position, which I perhaps have conveyed some of already in the discussions we had in respect of CNI, but obviously the River Iwi, and this was, came through in the evidence in the first week, and some of the questions that were put back and forth to Ms. May and others. The River Iwi, together with this council, members approved and supported PC1 as notified, because that reflected two things. One, that was their responsibility, but also it reflected their endorsement of the collaborative stakeholder group process, a process which the iwi themselves deliberately set back from. So they did not actively participate in the collaborative stakeholder group. There were Tangata Whenua people on that group, but not representatives of the Five River iwi, which they felt, given that they had ultimate responsibility of co-approving it to the council, that while no strict conflict would have arisen, that there needed to be some optics and some investment in this, and they felt that was a way of advancing that. So when that was notified, that was approved and supported by the River Iwi. But nonetheless, before the hearing came, they did seek to improve certain elements of it, so they did participate in that process. The panel's decision then was also supported by the iwi in principle, and particularly in respect of what could be described as its core decisions, and namely six matters. First, the interpretation of the status and effect of the Te Rewa Mana in a general sense. Secondly, increasing the improvement required in a 10-year period, after which PC1 becomes operative to 20% of the long-term goals. Thirdly, retaining a long-term water quality goal to be achieved by 2096. Fourth, signalling that resource consents for farming and commercial vegetable production should generally not be granted for durations beyond 2035. Fifth, signalling further diffuse discharge reductions of future management regimes, including potentially allocation of diffuse discharges of contaminants in subsequent plan change, because that was especially signalled originally, and retaining, or at least purporting to retain, as addressed further below, a pathway to develop Tangata Whenua ancestral land, being land returned through to the Waitangi settlement processes, or land having the status of Māori federal land under the jurisdiction of the Te Whenua Māori Act, a matter which I'll turn to at the end. However, as reflected in the River Iwi appeal, there were aspects of the decision's version the iwi did not support on the basis that, first, they were inconsistent with or undermined the core decisions above. Secondly, the drafting was unclear or not sufficiently linked to the core decisions. And third, there was a consequential and material risk that the operative PC1 in that form would not achieve the intent of the panel decision and, importantly, the required 20% improvement. In particular, the River Iwi considered and still consider that the Tangata Whenua ancestral land-related policies and rules were inadequate and ineffective, likely amounting to little more than window dressing in terms of a realistic prospect of securing consent for land use change in relation to Tangata Whenua ancestral land. Secondly, were further undermined by the new permissive provisions in the decision version enabling expansion of CVP and policy 3D and rule 311.48 and the intensification of grass crop farming under rule 311.43. And third, to that degree, essentially reflected a picking of winners, with Tangata Whenua ancestral land not being one of the medalists, and particularly and compounded by the interconnected removal of the end or sunset date of 1 July 2026 from Rule 311.49, the non-compliant activity land use change rule. Now, as matters presently stand today, and having regard to the progress and further agreements and understandings that have been achieved on certain matters through the course of the appeals process, and ongoing discussions and refinements between parties, between council and the exchanges with the court, the River Iwi support much of the revised version of PC1 now advanced by the Regional Council, being that attached to the legal submissions of the Regional Council dated 18 September 2023. And the Herculean efforts of Mr. Kabilko are acknowledged in that respect. That said, there are some fundamental bottom lines to the River Iwi in PC1 that they consider must still be maintained, where certain other parties may still seek to alter them, and or must maintain, or matters that should be included or reinforced where the current provisions in the Council's revised version remain inadequate or unsatisfactory, including particularly the provisions relating to Tangata Whenua ancestral land, which I will return to. But the following section is on context, and I don't propose to step through that. It goes to the historical work and some design aspects that reinforce the four statements I've made anyway regarding the importance and foundation of Te Tiriti Whanganga and its development, but it's there as a separate contextual section. The legal framework, again, I'll propose to highlight a couple of matters, but don't intend to traverse this in detail. There's a lot of consistency in broad terms between council in terms of the approach to Te Tiriti Whanganga as a legal matter, and it reflects a pleasing progression, I suppose, from where matters were before the hearing panel, where there was, as the hearing panel's decisions reveals, quite some contestation and views about all the manner of tensions and conflicts and which have prevailed over what, but that does seem to have abated significantly, if not entirely. The first few paragraphs I just deal with the status, which I was well aware of, and the footnotes were there, and including the multiple ones to the relevant sections of the different river acts, which are somewhat unhelpful, I think the hearing panel just referring to the Waikato legislation essentially was simpler. But in fairness, there are other provisions in the other legislation as well, and they should be expressly acknowledged. As I noted in paragraph 28, if amended through a review, the regional plan must be reviewed. That's a review of Te Tiriti Whanganga. The regional plan must be reviewed and updated to give effect to Te Tiriti Whanganga, and that's the brief conversation we had yesterday, sir, under that's done under section 13 of the Waikato River Settlement Act, and it's one where you are directly giving effect to Te Tiriti Whanganga in its own right, not through the RPS process, whereas what we are doing here is because of the deeming of Te Tiriti Whanganga to be part of the RPS, and we are thus giving effect to the RPS and thereby giving effect to Te Tiriti Whanganga. And that's not to say we are all on the force by any stretch with an RPS regional plan connectivity, but it's that legal mechanism through section 67, I think it was of the enforcement connect that we're dealing with. Now, I do just note for completeness in paragraph 29 that status is maintained expressly in section 104 of the recently enacted Natural and Built Environment Act, which it provides this time in the Act itself rather than in the river legislation, so people are squarely before people to Te Tiriti Whanganga is intended by Parliament to be the primary direction setting document for the Waikato and Waikato River and activity within the catchment affecting the rivers. And then it notes in subsection 2 to Te Tiriti Whanganga prevails over any inconsistent provision in the National Planning Framework, which is the amorphous, multifaceted document that's going to subsume, consume, and perhaps add to the existing array of national planning instruments. So it prevails over anything in that. In its entirety, is deemed to, because we're moving away from regional planning's policy statements, we now have spatial plans over on one side and natural and built environment plans, and they are kind of a hybrid of various bits of things. We are going to have a singularly, as we thought that this was an interesting challenge, we are going to have a challenge if this stays in its current form where the entirety of Te Tiriti Whanganga is deemed to be part of any plan made under the Act, so it'll be dropping down to the equivalent right into the regional plan. Perhaps picking up on that kind of difficulty of it, you just put it in the plan, it doesn't really help you very far, but then it adds to that and then says, the remainder of the plan must give effect to Te Tiriti Whanganga. So it's a give effect, an operative give effect within the new plan, which some might be pleased that we're dealing with it under the ANA for the moment. But the parliamentary intent so far is to continue and adapt to the new regime. And just as an aside, there, for those who have got to the towards the back of that weighty volume of legislation. There are a whole lot of provisions in relation to the Treaty of Waitangi commitments, which the Crown wasn't able to reach agreement on, let alone engage in some cases in terms of updating all existing treaty settlement arrangements to ensure that they maintain equivalence under the new NVEA and SVA regime. And the Crown is committed to do that and is part way through with many people, including the River Iwi. And this section reflects stage one of an agreement, but there's a whole multiple other layers within the river legislation of the three iwi that still need to be updated to fit within the greatly changed regional landscape of planning committees and things of that nature, which have a degree of independence from council and how that quite works. And there are provisions in that which make those commitments, or the process towards those commitments, to update those commitments, a statutory obligation on the ground. And there are some time frames in there and some deferrals for at least 2 years of the introduction of new and creation of new NVEA plans and to allow those negotiations to conclude and those updates to be agreed. And I suspect we will either have an omnibus legislation, piece of legislation, or a series of amendment bills that will update settlement acts all around the country in order to make sure they properly stick with the two new pieces of legislation. It might be faster to repeal the two new pieces of legislation, but I'm not sure that's a useful step forward. But it shows that things, as much as we're on a journey here, that journey's going to change in shape and nature, potentially in the near future. The next section just deals with legal effect, and I appreciate some of my friends have addressed this as well. I think we are in an interesting position where we've kind of got commentary regarding give effect in the context of Kingstown. Standing that is useful, albeit purely within a resource management orthodox planning process, and grappling with giving effect to a single national planning document in terms of the National Coastal Policy Statement, and whether one needs to refer back to Part 2 and whether there's need for priority and matters in that respect. And obviously we're in a situation here where the document we're talking about isn't a national document, it's a regional document that has the same status and it also prevails over national documents which have a similar good effect. So there's some nuances that probably need to be worked through there. We've also helpfully got the decision of the Supreme Court in Ngāti Tāmaki, which grapples with a give effect to obligation, albeit in relation to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi rather than to define on it in the context of Section 4 of the Conservation Act.
And to interpretation and administration.
Yes, which is an interesting point. And I mean, administration has certainly been, and it's quite clear from the Supreme Court's decision, administration was the exercise of powers and functions.
I'm not trying to narrow it. It's just, I think, quite important to see it that way.
I agree.
There's an issue in relation to the NVEA where ostensibly the broad provision that everyone making decisions under the NVEA had to give effect to the principles of the treaty, how far that extended. And now, of course, there is a note about 400 sections away from it, just to note that in terms of judicial decision making, we are certainly to take that into account in our decision making, but we are not ourselves required to give effect to the principles of the treaty.
Yes.
Not sure if you've
heard
that.
I am intimately familiar with
right.
All layers of that.
Oh, well. You may stand alone in the legal landscape, even compared to the Parliamentary Council's office.
Well, yes, I was closely involved and aware of the nature and content of the submission and the consequent effect of that, which is an interesting one, depending on the role of which playing. and it needs to be judged in its context and relative to the scheme in which it's operating. If we were coming to this, we might be dealing with some slightly different matters, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Development of legislation is a fascinating exercise. The other thing, in terms of that was a useful observation in losing my tie, was when grappling with that and other statutory obligations, and in fact other considerations outside the statutory scheme, but normally seem to be relevant, the Supreme Court observing that, you know, that it's not a question of matters being overridden or needing to be balanced against a give effect to Section 4 obligation, but rather those objectives and considerations must be achieved in a way that best gives effect to the relevant principles of the treaty. And applying that within this context, it's just leads us to looking where we do have other instruments coming in and where they're not necessarily inconsistent, but they might pull in other directions. The indication of the Supreme Court, when reached in that context, is, and it applies, and accepting that it's a slightly different context, is that one should be using the TTFI manner as a constant touchstone and looking to how one can best give effect to the TTFI manner. Admitting we're doing this in a stage process anyway, within the context of those other drivers that the court and decision makers have to grapple with.
Yes, well, it's very, as with most of these things and a number of the things you've already touched on, binary analysis is unlikely to get you terribly far in trying to cope with all of the things that have to be coped with. But in terms of a direction, in terms of a higher order consideration, the TTFI mana is at the top, if not, or at least very close to the top.
Yes, and I think that was the kind of observation made on Cookie Cole and also Carter Holt about that there probably isn't another regional level planning document that has this weight within the planning regime, or within any planning regime perhaps. And certainly, despite the fact that the TTFI mana drives into a range of other statutory regimes related to natural resources as well, including conservation legislation. I do note in just from paragraph 38, 39 and 40 that there are some particular interpretation clauses within each of the River Settlement Acts, and they are guiding principles of interpretation for those acts. As I say, this is where that slight shift, when you here are operating primarily within the obligation to give effect to the RPS, you are essentially operating within interpreting what the RMA requires one to do. There are other aspects, including the type of community where those obligations are driving directly out of the river legislation and where these guiding principles will apply to that. And I think the interwoven nature of it, again, I won't take this too far, but if one's looking for touchstones and guidance along the way, then I think the statutory context and the guiding principles of interpretation that are within each of those three river acts are also relevant and helpful in terms of reconfirming, re-emphasising the commonality of goals and direction and purpose. There's not a tension point there, but these things are always layers, and we've seen that in the court cases involving the treaty over the years, that these things have layers. And this one is as complicated as any in that regard. So what is useful is that when one does trace through these interconnected suites of legislation and legislative intent, albeit that it's manifesting through different statutory vehicles, there is a commonality throughout that of intent and direction.
To use another phrase and to look at it from the opposite vantage point, they don't pull in different directions.
Yes, correct. We do not have a push and pull you beast on our hands.
So no one has suggested, and we're not about to start to inquire into the subtleties that you've set out for us so helpfully, to see if we gap in the various forms in which the same concepts have been set out in legislation.
I go on to discuss probably a little bit, and try not to be used to it, but a little bit the layering of the vision, objectives and strategies, because you're right, but it's a singular vision and strategy to 35.9 that must be given effect to, but it's constructed in a way that, I must admit, I somewhere deep inside I bristled when it was somebody simplified it into, oh, this is the same as an objective and a plan, and this is the same as a policy and a plan, this is the same as a rule and a plan. As I think that does a disservice to the drafters and the intent behind it. I mean, I don't appreciate what was trying to be done, which was to try and put us in place within an RMA interpretive realm, but it was only done by analogy. But what we do have is we've got the overarching, what I would say, the primary overarching, arching statement of vision, which has been ostracised. Then we've got a series of objectives that are to be pursued in order to realise the statement of vision. And then finally, a series of strategies that are to be implemented to achieve the objectives.
I think the analogy can be important. Again, the court sometimes faces submissions of parties who seek to identify a single provision somewhere in a statutory planning document and hang all of their hat on that without seeing what you have been clear about, which is the interconnected nature of these provisions. I don't think there can be any, and I mean, you referred to Vicky Cole, and again, as you say, there is a need to read the 35.9 in its entirety and to approach giving effect to it in its entirety.
That's correct, and that's the point I made, and I think that the hearing panel noted in relation to this, that one can go through each of the objectives and strategies, and they do resonate in different ways to different people, but the common threads in the overall intent must be viewed as a whole, and one can't reasonably deconstruct it, and certainly not deconstruct it in a introspective, subjective, single purpose way for a particular end.
Or overly legalistic, right?
Oh, exactly. That's for someone to write an academic exercise about at some point, which I'll never have the time to do, given my difficulty with writing at the best of times.
Just timing was the
But I did just note a couple of matters that resonated through there. I think the strategies in particular, I did run through some of those in questioning of a couple of witnesses, and I think as I go on to say in relation to both the objectives and the strategies, is that they each warrant consideration, but you must keep the overarching purpose as a constant reference. And as I say, in paragraph 1, which is what we've just discussed, to do climate, I must in that respect be viewed holistically, but in doing so, not skipping away or diluting into key words and intent. And similarly, the strategies must reasonably be interpreted and applied by reference to the vision, which in turn is clearly focused on the restoration of protection. However, important touchstones when considering or weighing different approaches within PC1 in terms of the methods of achieving the city climate. And I did see someone suggesting that the strategies were perhaps more analogous to methods in an RM planning sense, and that might be right to some degree. And I think when one looks at the methods and when you're grappling with the methods, there is some useful touchstones and guidance if there are matters of which way should this go. If one goes to those the strategies, they give some fairly clear intent at the very least. Whether that can be practically realised is always another matter. I then note section 17, subsection 3 of the Waikato Water Settlement Act, which is also repeated in 18.3 of the Upper River Act, and this is the provision I talked about regarding persons carrying out functions or exercising powers of the RMA that must have particular regard to the 35.9, in addition to any requirements specified. Now, the hearing panel took the approach, and I think this is what Your Honour was suggesting the other today as well, well, not in the same terms, that that obligation is effectively subsumed, within the direction that PC1 wants to affect his examiner, arising from it being deemed to be part of the RPS, although the current panel observed that the positional obligation nevertheless does tend to emphasise the central role played by Tetiri Paimana in our deliberations. And I accept that as a base proposition, and I think the overall tenor of that statement is correct, and Your Honour indicated a similar comment when we were talking about, well, the objective identification for Section 32 purposes is, you know, fits into that zone. I think the point I just wanted to note and perhaps emphasise, and again, it's coming back to things that resonate and repeat, apart from myself, is that this obligation reinforces the importance of the 35-month, not only as an overarching goal or objective in our own planning terms, but also as a reference point that should resonate and be had particular regard to, as the clause requires, at each point of the assessment and decision-making process. It's not a mere gateway, nor simply an outcome to be achieved, but it's also a statutorily prescribed guide throughout the process. And again, I'm not saying that it will always have some kind of operative effect, but it's only had particular regard to. But again, when one is perhaps in the balance of considering a particular provision, and while one's trying to give effect to 35 as a whole, that one can then have regard to it at sub-decision levels and sub-obligations within the process towards to 35 minor, including Section 32, notification system, other types of things. I think it's a helpful additional layer to have, and it allows one to think of the whole, but also think of the component parts that you're grappling with as well. So I just didn't want to let it to disappear entirely from the landscape. So that's probably the legal pattern to me. I wanted to touch on the EPS FM. I don't intend to read through all of this, but it has been a subject of discussion and question and some submission. Obviously, the latest EPS FM, as I explored with Ms. Ma, elevates the concept of phenomenal delay, encompassing a set of six principles and a hierarchy of priorities with which place with the health and well-being of water bodies and related ecosystems first. Now, there's significant synergy with the Tiwi Whanganga and no overt inconsistency, but the river we consider the EPS FM 2020, while a relevant consideration, cannot reasonably be delivered through PC1 at this time, and should not be viewed in such terms. Putting to one side the priority that Te Tiwi Whanganga has over the EPS FM in terms of substantive legal effect, the amendment of the regional plan to give effect to the EPS FM is a process that must have the iwi and tangata whenua at its heart, not only in terms of the express provisions within the EPS that is, as I can see, to have the iwi embedded throughout it, procedurally and substantively, but also due to the joint management agreement or obligations between the River Iwi and the Regional Council. Accordingly, the River Iwi are looking to that process, which is imminent, to engage in substance with the NPS FM 2020 and its implementation alongside the ongoing implementation of Te Tiwi Whanganga through PC1. In the interim, however, the River Iwi do note again the overarching purpose of the Acts, to restore and protect the health and well-being of the river in Waikato and Waipa. And it's apparent, therefore, that the policy intent of Te Mana o Te Wai within the context of the NPSM is broadly synonymous with the overarching purpose of the River Acts and related deeds, and also the vision into Te Whanganga. But the reason of the preference of the river iwi to speak to Te Whanganga in the context of PC1 is that represents a collective position centred on the Waikato and Waipai rivers, where they would otherwise each articulate the concepts of Te Mana o Te Wai and related to this Te Mana o Te Awa in slightly different ways with reference to their individual tikanga, histories and relationships with different parts of the awa. And I give some examples about the different terminology that's used by Waikato Whānau in relation to Te Mana o Te Awa. as a term of their greater to their relationship in view of the Waikato River. Now I think many of people are talking in terms of Te Mana o Te Awa, Te Awa o Waipa, and Te Mana o Te Wai, and Te Mana Tuku Iho o Waiwa'a, when referring to their tikanga-like responsibilities in relation to the Waipa River. And while the Upper Waikato River does not expressly refer to Te Mana o Te Wai or Te Mana o Te Awa, the environment plans of those three really speak authoritatively to their relationship and rights and obligations to the Waikato River, which remain part of providing for the health and wellbeing of the river. So
there is a material distinction in that those iwi seek to identify their own position.
Yes.
And while an outsider may say, I see commonality, I see consistency, I see these things which I can draw together, that must never denigrate or detract from the independence of each iwi, because that's what their identification and their tikanga and their whole approach is based on.
That's what it demands. It's a matter of right and responsibility. And that's exactly, and I'm probably going to say that to probably not in eloquent words, as you want, just down in paragraph 63, but they have come together for this purpose because they are united in this collectivity, but they certainly would never suggest that they have or should be treated as a homogenous whole with common view.
Unity does not take away from independence. That's something that a lot of people probably need to think about.
And I think, therefore, in terms of grappling with the NPS and those processes, which the iwi may in some part collectivise on, but they may individually aspire to express and have articulated their various tikanga and values against Te Mana o Te Wai and their equivalent tikanga and kawa. And through the NPSM process, that has to occur before one can start importing wholesale concepts from the NPSM without that important translation vehicle, I suppose, in exposition. And so there's nothing adverse to the NPSFM, the Waikato Five Iwi, Waikato River Iwi, Waikato River Iwi, active members of the National Iwi Chairs Forum. They were formative in the original articulation of Te Mana o Te Wai that first crept in 2014 and have pushed throughout. But again, that's a global concept for the benefit of all, but then needs to be articulated, as you've noted, through individual Iwi and how it ends that place. And that process needs to occur. I then reach the final part, which is these are the key issues in summary form that the Liberal Iwi wish to emphasise, and there's technical layers beneath them, obviously, but the three referee witnesses are yet to appear, so, and there are matters which no doubt people can explore with them regarding some of the detail that sits behind them. But these are I've called them fundamental bottom lines, but they are the matters of critical focus and attention. First, the headings capture a suite of matters in part. FEPs and fencing, both started with F, it seems nice. Farm environment plans and related standards, including those related to stock exclusion in Schedules A through D2, are a critical part of PC1, as is something else that I did not complete at the end of that sentence, but it was the breaking down of farming statuses into their intensity classifications is also being critical to the way in which PC10 operates. Is another management tool to which the reduction is required. However, content, quality, consistency, certainty and compliance are essential moving forward. To this end, in addition to various participation through the joint witness statement processes and other engagement. The referee we have proposed and done some work in the last day through Mr. Brough to on a refinement of Schedule C in that vein, which he can talk to and has been circulated. But they're otherwise broadly comfortable with where most of the other elements have landed, or at least appear to be heading. That said, the court's careful consideration of those elements is welcomed.
We might take the morning.
What is that? I'm sorry.
I know you've only got a little way to go.
No, that's okay. I think
you'll get to paragraph 74, and I expect there'll be some